The following presentation was recorded at the 2012 Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute. More information at thedocforlearning.org.
Dangerous cliff, as they freely confessed, though to walk near its crest was so pleasant, but over its dangerous edge there had slipped a duke and many a peasant. So the people said something would have to be done, but their projects did not at all tally. Some said, build a fence round the top of the cliff. Others, an ambulance down in the valley. But the cry for the ambulance carried the day, for it spread to the neighboring city. A fence may be useful or not, it is true, but each heart became brimful of pity for those who slipped o'er that dangerous cliff, and dwellers in highway and alley gave pounds and gave pence, not to put up a fence, but an ambulance down in the valley. For the cliff is all right if you're careful, said they, and if folks even slip and are dropping. It isn't the slipping that hurts them so much as the shock down below when they're stopping. So day after day as these mishaps occurred, quick forth would the rescuers sally to pick up the victims that fell off the cliff with their ambulance down in the valley. Then an old man remarked, it's a marvel to me, that people give far more attention to repairing results than to stopping the cause, when they'd much better aim at prevention. Let us stop at its source, this mischief, cried he. Come, neighbors and friends, let us rally. If the cliff we will fence, we might almost dispense with the ambulance down in the valley. Oh, he's a fanatic, the others rejoined. Dispense with the ambulance? Never. He'd dispense with all charities, too, if he could. No, no. We'll support them forever. Aren't we picking up folks just as fast as they fall? Shall this man dictate us? Shall he? Why should people of sense stop to put up a fence while the ambulance works in the valley? But a sensible few, who are practical, too, won't put up with such nonsense much longer. They believe that prevention is better than cure, and their number will soon be the stronger. Support them then with your purse, voice, and pen, and while other philanthropists dally, they will scorn all pretense and build a strong fence on the cliff that hangs over the valley. Better guide well the young than reclaim them when old. The voice of true wisdom is calling. To rescue the fallen is good, that is true, but 'tis best to prevent them from falling. Better close up the source of temptation and crime than deliver from dungeon and galley. Better build a strong fence round the top of the cliff than an ambulance down in the valley. Now, I opened this session with this poem to point out the tendency of unthinking humanity to treat symptoms rather than to analyze and remove the cause. To treat symptoms rather than to analyze and remove the cause. Now, if you will have been looking through the program of this institute, you will notice that there's a recurring theme, and the theme has to do with vision. And perhaps you're tired of hearing about vision. It's a word that is sometimes overused and misused, but there's a recurring theme about vision, and there's a reason for that. There is a sense in which perhaps the zeal for Christian education is on the wane. And we'll talk later about some evidences that, yes, indeed, there is evidence that this is the case. The word zeal means the eagerness and ardent pursuit of something. The synonym is passion. When President Teddy Roosevelt was a little boy, he had a nickname. They called him Teddy. So Teddy Roosevelt, when he was a little boy, was afraid to go to church. And it was more than just an idle fear. It was actually so bad that when his family wanted to go to church, he became violently ill.
And so he was questioned, well, what is it that makes you so afraid? And he said, well, I'm afraid of the zeal that's out there in the dark corners of the church. You're afraid of the zeal. And so his mother asked, well, what does zeal look like? Well, it's probably like an alligator or maybe like a dragon, but it's crouching there in the dark corner somewhere there in the church. And then they remembered that the pastor had preached on John 2:17, where it says that then they remembered, this was after Jesus cleared the temple, that it was written, the zeal of thine house has eaten me up. Now the less funny postscript is that these days it's fairly safe for little boys and little girls to go to church, since there is not much zeal in many cases lurking around in the corners. And I think that there is a parallel. It's relatively safe for boys and girls to go to church to go to school these days as well. There is not as much zeal lurking in the corners there that might eat them up as there was at one time. I'm speaking metaphorically, of course. There are several focuses of this address here this morning. And the first one is the future generation. So I want for us to think multi-generationally. Think of not only the present generation, but the future generation and the past generations as well. But the future generation is the generation of children and the youth who will be the future Anabaptist church leaders and teachers and preachers and missionaries and businessmen and the moms and the dads that will populate our pews. These are the focus that we're considering here this morning. And then there are also the decision makers, the ones that are making the strategic decisions. And they are this rising generation's moms and dads, especially the age 25 to 40 group, I might add, who are the parents of today's students. And the outcome of today's students, the rising generation, will largely be the result of the growing or the declining vision for Christian education. The question is, how can we nurture this rising generation to embrace a compelling vision for Christian education that will prepare their children to live the distinctive lifestyle of Anabaptism in a meaningful way within our culture? What are we doing today to mature the rising generation in an Anabaptist worldview? So here are some questions that I'll pose, and then we'll talk about these or consider them further as we in the next few minutes. Questions to ask ourselves. Does the way that our children are being educated equip them with the attitudes and the values and the skills and the knowledge that our people need? Secondly, does the way our children are being educated match who we are as an Anabaptist people? Does the way our children are being educated support and build our churches? There's a sense sometimes in which we work on Sundays to undo what we have planted during the week. Is education for the sake of gain? Here's a question that I think we must answer as a people. And it has presented itself for a variety of reasons. And we won't go into those, but I think we should at least mention it. Is education for the sake of gaining knowledge serving our future best interests? I think more and more these days there are students who are graduating from our schools and without a specific trade or profession in mind have an interest in furthering their education. And so we must ask ourselves, will this serve our future best interests, and how can we direct this this initiative. How can we prepare our children for a meaningful Christian life in an Anabaptist vision and worldview without fostering Anabaptist arrogance? We'll talk about that later if there's time. And number six, we must have an understanding that we tend toward a false sense of confidence and security. And I want to qualify that by saying that our rising generation must be challenged to understand that we do not hold a monopoly on truth that passes seamlessly from generation to generation, and we must create this awareness. It is work. It is a task that we must give ourselves to. Now, in view of the fence or the ambulance, the tendency we have without thinking through to immediately try to bandage the wounds without thinking of what is causing the wounds in the first place, in that frame of mind, let's think about correctly identifying the problem. If it is true, and if we generally agree that it is not automatically, seamlessly going to happen that vision passes from generation to generation, that there must be a conscious effort made to pass on the vision. If that is true, and if it is also true that the evidence would tell us that there is vision that is waning, there is vision that is dying, then it is important that we correctly identify the problem. Now, I remember hearing years ago of a traveler who was traveling through a rugged mountain country, and he asked his guide who was leading him, "How do you make your way over the jagged peaks on treacherous trails without losing your direction?" And the guide said, "I have the near look and the far vision. With one eye, I watch what's right in front of me, and with the other eye, I guide my course by the stars." Now, I'm not promoting that we guide our course by the stars, but I am saying that, brethren and sisters, as we consider the education of our children in our times and preparing ourselves for the future, we need the near look and we need the far vision. And they must be working on parallel tracks. To focus on one without the other will not achieve our goals, but to focus on, but only the mere look, the near look, without the far vision, will cause us to be put bandages on the wounds. Will cause us to run the ambulance endlessly, without ever thinking about where the fence ought to be built and how it ought to be built. And again, I speak metaphorically there. So what approach should we take? Recently, I came across an article in Forbes magazine that was entitled, "The Secret Sauce." The Secret Sauce. And I read this with interest, since I have seen first in obscure places in stores and then right up there by the cash register. And then it wasn't only in stores, it was in filling stations, and then it was in Walmart, and then it was in most places where there's an impulse section right next to the cash register where people are taking their wallets out of their pockets. You'll find displays of 5-hour energy. And I kind of wonder, what's with this? And by the way, I'm not advocating the use of it, but what's come about here? And so this article, "The Secret Sauce," tells about the mystery man behind the 5-hour energy that has become, in the past year, a $1 billion retail trade. $600 million at wholesale. $300 million he netted. And I think it's indicative of a culture and a society that is looking for a quick fix and is looking for instant solutions. And it's for that reason that the booksellers of our day are finding that the bestsellers, and read some of the bestseller lists if you are wondering about this, are the how-to, the three easy steps to whatever, and the five ways to do this. My all-time favorite is one that I just saw the other day that said, how to have a new husband by Friday. And I didn't buy the book, but I was curious enough to know what's behind all this. And it has to do with a wife taking 5 easy steps, one per day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, to change the attitude of her husband, and that way she won't have to change him. I mean, find a new one. You can just change the one you've got. But again, just to underscore, there is this, that we are a culture and a society that is looking for a quick, easy fix to whatever it is that ails us. And that is the near look. And what I'm appealing to us this morning in this address is that we take a far vision. We need the far vision. We take a look. We lift our eyes up onto the horizon. The man behind the 5-hour energy first began to, he first came across the product, and it was a 16-ounce bottle. And he said, you know what? I don't think that people that are need energy and are just tired are also thirsty. So what you need to do is just take those same ingredients and just put them in a little bottle that you can just glug, glug, and and a few quick swallows, and then it's you're revitalized without a crash, 5 hours from now. And that caught a hold, and it has become a billion-dollar industry. And here's what he said. Getting it next to the register isn't hard. Keeping it there is very hard. And I would say, kind of building on this analogy, that there is no secret sauce to the endeavor of nurturing a vision for Christian education in the rising generation. There is no quick fix. There is no secret recipe to it. It is very hard. It is hard work. It's hard to get it next to the it's hard to keep it there. But it is a work of constant diligence that we must avail ourselves of and work at it constantly and work at it very diligently. I have, by the way, I know that I've gone to lots of conventions, and there are places, those kind of conventions where it's advertised that if you come, you will find something here at this convention that you can take home and immediately put into use. And that's lauded as a very good reason to come to an event such as this. And that is true. I think you will find some things on the agenda that will lend themselves to things you can put to use immediately. But at the same time, there is running through the theme of this entire day and a half that we will spend together is this theme of how can we, on a larger plane, how can we inspire vision. We have a fireplace at home in our house, and when we build a fire there, I have noticed that just lighting the fire can be a challenge. But once the fire is burning, it flames brightly, and it kind of feeds upon the wood, and it's crackling and snapping, and the wood is being consumed, and it's really burning. And there's a phase at which the wood has been totally kind of, I'll say, infiltrated by the fire. You know, it's the wood is still there. It's still, the logs are in their shape, but there's fire throughout, and it's really creating a lot of heat. And I've found that that's the best time to add more wood to the fire. Because when you put it on, then it kind of naturally lights, and it just and you extend the life of the fire and the length of the heat that you'll be receiving from it. But if you're distracted, like I often am, and I'm sitting there a world away, and I haven't been watching the fire, and all of a sudden I look into the fireplace, and it's kind of past that phase, and now you can still throw wood onto the fire. There's still some heat there, but it takes work to get that fire really burning and crackling again. And I would propose that perhaps we have seen this phase where it's easy to toss more wood on the fire kind of pass. And that we're at the point now where we must put wood on the fire, but it'll be some work to get the fire burning hotly again. So as you can tell by now, I'm approaching this topic from the perspective that many Christian day schools in plain communities are struggling. as we enter the second decade of the 21st century, we find that there are many day school, Christian day schools that are struggling. Well, in what ways are they struggling, you might ask? They are struggling financially. They are struggling to maintain long-term teaching staff. Schools are struggling to maintain student census. And in some communities, families are sending children to public schools. In some communities, there is families are homeschooling primarily out of frustration with the struggle of the Christian day school. So it's important that we properly identify the source of this trouble. What is causing us to struggle? And I would propose that a declining vision for Christian education is not a standalone school issue. Rather, it is paralleling a larger dilemma, and it is related to the worldview of a declining Anabaptist worldview in our churches. And it is simply manifesting itself through the schools more prominently than in some other places. And if that is the case, then we must work on the source and address the problems there. If it is not merely an issue of education, but a declining worldview, then it follows that improving the quality of education in our schools, while important, and we must ever be working at it, improving the quality alone of education will not renew the vision for Christian education. Reducing the peer pressure that creates poor self-images that is somewhat so systemic in our schools, while that's important and we must ever be working at it, in and of itself will not renew the vision for Christian education. Discouraging homeschooling to bolster declining enrollment in and of itself will not renew the vision for Christian education. Updating curriculum, while that is strategically important, and we must ever be working at it, in and of itself will not renew the vision for Christian education. I would propose that it's not just a matter of somehow persuading our, excuse the language, customers that we have a superior product and you ought to be buying from us rather than elsewhere. It is a much larger issue. It's a question of worldview, and it's a question of our value system. And nothing we can do in the educational process in and of itself is going to renew the vision without the renewal of a worldview that embraces Anabaptism, the Anabaptist lifestyle, and understanding who we as a people of God are and what God has called us to be. Some of you may know or have read the book Kingdom Focused Finances for the Family, authored by Gary Miller from Idaho. And I asked Gary for his perspective on this conference, or the institute here, and on this subject. And here's what he said. You know, Paul, I have written that book, Kingdom Focused Finances for the Family, and there are many people have read it, and I'm asked to come to various churches and give talks about this book. And so we've developed a series of three seminars that he presents in churches. He said, here's what I've learned. Many people have read the book, many people come to the seminars, and what they are hoping to find and hear is they're hoping for a quick fix, some budgeting tricks, something to do to make their dollars go further, so that in essence they can continue to maintain the lifestyle that we've become accustomed to, but at the same time giving more support and better support to our charities and works of mercy. And when they come, what they find is that all I do is that we don't talk about budgeting, we don't talk about expense allocation, we don't talk about all these things, all we talk or how to increase your income, we talk about the values in your own heart. Because the reality is that we spend our money based upon our values. And we buy what we value the most. So if there is not enough money to go around, or not enough money to properly support our Christian schools and missions and charities and works of mercy, then the answer is to look into our own hearts and re-establish our values. And I would say that is a that is paralleled in our vision for Christian education. Until we get to the point where we as a people have a kingdom-focused, kingdom-focused family vision, where our highest value is the future generation's training to prepare them to be the people of God, then we can fix whatever it is we want to fix. And we must do all of the things that we're about today in Christian education, but it will be an upward struggle until we get to the point where we realign our values. So what can be done? Well, there are things that we can do. Brother Jonas Sauter, when he asked me to take this topic, he said in essence something like this: we cannot force feed Christian education vision to those who lack it. Then what are things that we can do to encourage the growth of a healthy vision in the rising generation? And I would say, first of all, just understand and awareness, we are not dealing with education alone, but with a worldview. Therefore, while our schools have their role to play, schools, principals, administrators must cause church leaders to understand that vision for Christian education is only one component of a much broader vision question, a question of worldview. And this worldview and its corresponding counterculture values. Let me repeat that. This worldview, this understanding, and let me explain just a bit, this understanding that we are the people of God, this understanding that God has called us to be a people of God, His children in our generation, delivering a message that largely has been lost throughout Christendom. And as we as a people go into other cultures, the Muslim world, into Southeast Asia, what we are hearing is that we did not know that there are Americans who believe such things. And it's part of this worldview which we are sending, and we send our children, our young people, who have been in our churches, they've heard the preaching from our pulpits, they've gone to our schools, they've gone to our Bible schools and to our institutes, and some of them are sent into foreign mission endeavors and find themselves woefully unprepared in worldview. So it has to be preached from our pulpits. It must be reflected in our devotionals. It must be taught in our Sunday schools. It must be supported in our giving. It's part and parcel of it's not just a question of school vision. It's a part of our church vision. It's a part of our understanding who we are as a people of God. Think about the prayers that were prayed by Nehemiah and the prayers that were prayed by Daniel. These were men of God who were on their knees and they were confessing the sins of their people, sins that they themselves never had committed. But these were men with a multi-generational view. They had this sense that we are the people of God, and God is working through us. God we are the ones through whom the all of the earth will be blessed, and we have this we have this unction from on high to demonstrate the character and the nature of God in our generation. So they had this sense of peoplehood and this sense of destiny, and it caused them to fall on their knees and to pray before God. It caused them to rise up with vision and with plan, and they were the kind of men who could stay the course and do more, but actually turn the course of a people of God who were on the wane away from God and turn them and bring them back. Turn them back toward God. And brethren and sisters, this is at the heart of what I am trying to communicate to you this morning. It's a question of vision. And while all the other tasks and the projects are important and they need be done, overarching it all is a question of vision. Do we understand who we are as the people of God? Do we understand that our schools and the teaching that we provide in our schools and our curriculum are all part and parcel of a much larger work to be the people of God that He has called us to be? There is no easy sauce. It's the work of a lifetime. Let us put our hands to the work. From the pulpits, from the teachers' desks, from the lecterns, from the Sunday school devotional to the Sunday school classroom, and in every place that we can push forward the vision to be the people of God. Let us put our hands to the task. Thank you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.